condolences.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Some of us have had the opportunity to sit in those positions, so we know what it's like. I'd also like to introduce Angela Medrano, who's a longtime colleague of mine, but Deputy Secretary for the Human Services Department. Okay, and I don't see Russell here yet, but I'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. And as many of you Medicaid Advisory Committee members as can find a place at the table here, the better. If you can't, try to sit towards the front of the group that's in the audience. We'll go ahead and start off with introductions here at the table, and then we'll go into the audience, starting with Jason.
Sure. Good morning. Jason Sanchez, Deputy Director here at the Medical Assistance Division.
Good morning. Mary Eden, Presbyterian, representing the Centennial Care Managed Care Organization.
Larry Chandler, Pediatrician, representing pediatricians and all other physicians.
Joey Glenn, substituting for Megan Marino, representing Hospice
Agency. Gary Alseptian, representing Disability Rights for Mexico.
Mark Coleman here for Jim Coughlin, representing the Department of Health.
Thank you.
Ruth Hoffman with Woodford Advocacy Ministry of Mexico.
David Trace, Secretary Designate, already been introduced.
Nicole Cromwell, Medical Assistance Division Director, already been introduced.
Rick Madden, Family Physician from Belen, representing the New Mexico Academy of Family Physicians.
Carol Montoya, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, representing Advanced Practice Nurses and the College of Nursing.
I'm Larry Martinez with Presbyterian Medical Services, and I'm serving as chairman of the Medicaid Advisory Committee. Let's go ahead and get started. Well, let's have our introduction back here.
Alicia Bathron, Medical Assistance.
Good morning, everyone. Angela Medrano, Deputy Secretary.
Good morning. Mary Armijo, Deputy Director of the Medicaid Center.
Good morning, Megan Pepper, Deputy Director of Medicaid.
Good morning, Linda Gonzalez, Deputy Director of Medicaid.
Jeff Dye with the New Mexico Hospital Association.
Rodney McNeese with UNM Hospitals.
Jody Harris, UNM Hospital.
Sylvia Varela, CEO of the Santa Fe Recovery Center, representing the New Mexico Behavioral Health Providers Association.
Michael Spanier, representing Hyden Associates.
Jane Wishner, and I'm the Governor's Executive Policy Advisor on Health and Human Services.
Betty Bowman with the LSC.
Liz Lossiter, Presbyterian Health.
Good morning, I'm Patsy Nelson, representing the New Mexico Alliance for School-Based Healthcare.
Good morning, Renee Ennis with Tricor Reference Laboratories.
Denise Mazzal with Tricor Reference Laboratories.
Colin Bio with Health Action New Mexico.
Christopher Cameron with Western Sky Community Care.
Angelica Brunke with Versatile Man Analytics.
I'm Patty Kehoe with Wisdom Gate Consulting.
Dr. Caetano with Rocky Shields.
I'm a student at the
UN College of Nursing.
Chris Evans, Celgene.
Colin Pines, representing the Disability College.
Wayne Lindstrom, Director of the Behavioral Health Services Division.
Good morning, Mika Tari, Deputy Director of the VHSD.
Jack
Panetta,
Mental Health Division.
Michael Parks with the Senior Citizens Law Office at Albuquerque.
Someone who just came in the door.
Good morning. Ramona Dillard, Director of Community Health and Wellness for Arizona
Okay, and we've been joined at the table by two of our members also who did not introduce themselves. Let's go first by you.
Eileen Good, New Mexico Primary Care Association.
Dale Tinker, New Mexico Pharmacists Association.
I think we've got everyone introduced then. So we welcome you to this meeting. It is the annual meeting that we look at the Medicaid budget here at the state legislative session, as that's one of the major actions that's going to take place over the next few weeks. And let me direct the attention of the committee to the agenda, item number two. This agenda was previously distributed to all the members. Are there any changes, any modifications anyone wishes to make to the agenda? Seeing there are none, I will entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
So moved.
So moved by Carolyn and seconded by Eileen. Okay. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, the agenda is formally adopted. Let me also direct your attention to the minutes of the November 5th meeting, November 5th, 2018 meeting, which were also previously distributed to members of the Medicaid Advisory Committee. Are there any corrections or modifications that anyone wishes to make to the minutes of the previous meeting? Seeing that there are none, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
So moved.
So moved by Dr. Chandler. Is there a second to that motion?
Yes.
Okay, seconded by Dr. Madden. Okay, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, the minutes of our previous meeting have now been formally approved. Item number four on the agenda is the director's update, and Nicole, the floor is now yours. And again, welcome, and any way we can be of any help, don't hesitate to let us know.
Great, I will certainly take you up on that, I'm sure. Well, good morning again to everyone. I'm so excited to be here, and was really looking forward to this meeting and getting to meet all of you. I'm going to give a quick update because I know we got in late with the meetings transitioning in and out, and I want to make sure we get to the budget. But I did make some promises to the MCOs in our last meeting that I said I would follow up on briefly in this update that I think also will be of interest to the larger group here. So first and foremost, we wanted to provide a transition update and let you all know that the transition has gone well, and we are continuing to work very closely and monitor high-risk members and have worked very closely with the MCOs and think that's been a great collaboration. We're still having daily calls and requesting weekly staff reports from all of the carriers. Additionally, we amended the Centennial Care 2.0 contract and reissued a policy manual effective 1-1, and both of those have been posted to the HSD website, so folks can take a look. The next thing that we thought folks would be interested in, our 1115 waiver was approved in December. We're still finalizing a few of these standard terms and conditions, but the waiver itself is approved. In addition to that, and I know that Jane is here, so she can feel free to chime in, but the governor's office is reconsidering some of the provisions within the waiver. Namely, there were some policies for retroactive coverage, co-pays, and premiums. And I know that I told you all I would have an update, but things have been a little busy, it turns out, and we're actually meeting, Dr. Scrace and I are meeting with the governor's office at 11. So hopefully we'll be able to provide you a more concrete update in the next couple days. Let's see, the next thing I said that we would update you on is the Medicaid buy-in legislation. There hasn't been anything substantial to update the MCOs on, but for the rest of the group, we continue to work with the governor's office. I think we're anticipating that legislation to drop this week, so folks would get to take a look at that. I'm sure many of you saw the MNAT report, and there has been a lot of discussion about what options we might try to employ here in New Mexico, and that is still under discussion at this time. We are looking forward to continuing to work with the governor's office on what options we might explore. And I think in addition to that, did you want to add the charges that we were given as part of that exploration? That's okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and the rest of the group. As we're exploring other options for insuring more New Mexicans, I think there's a general agreement with HSD and with the governor's office that we're going to be doing everything we possibly can to identify those remaining New Mexicans who actually qualify for Medicaid, whose health care bill is paid in part by the state, in part by the federal government. For the same amount of money, we can insure five times as many of those folks as we can. If we're just paying for general funds. So, and we have a lot of numbers about what that number of people might be. We think maybe it's somewhere in the 30,000 range, but we're not sure. And then at the same time, I think it's evident to many of you, particularly providers in the room, that with the addition of the 250,000 people through the Affordable Care Act has put some strain on the network. We're not in a situation where we have much extra capacity, and so in addition to finding these Medicaid eligible people and getting them in Medicaid, our second priority is really to take active steps to
build our provider network further in order to have room to cover the people that we want to. So those are dual priorities. I sort of think of more as foundation stones or any other kind of extensions and insurance products that we would offer to people to get everybody eventually in New Mexico, at least with an opportunity to have affordable insurance.
So I know it was a brief update. I'm sure there'll be other questions, and we're happy to meet with folks after. But we did want to get to the budget, and I think those priorities that we mentioned, I think you'll see reflected. And beyond the two that David mentioned, I think we also have a focus on ensuring that when we do get those folks ready to come in and enroll, that we also have a system that's easy to use. So it's kind of a third tenet that we haven't focused as much on, but is definitely part of our ongoing conversations about how we want to improve access to all New Mexicans. So I believe that's it, unless I missed anything. But okay, thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Nicole. Okay, are there any questions or any comments anyone wishes to make from the committee? Yes, Jeff.
Quick question. Maybe you said it and all that, but and welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
Jeff Guy from the Hospital Association. For either one of you, the flip side of all of that around Medicaid buy-in and provider networks and so forth, does the department have any particular plan at the moment for any different enrollment process or any more aggressiveness on that front of expanding what we do have within the program in conjunction with buy-in or other issues?
So I'm not sure if this is exactly what you're getting at, but we have been looking to improve the real-time eligibility functionality within the system. That is scheduled to be completed, actually, I believe, in this year. Yeah, this year. Early this year. There's a lot of competing priorities, as you all know, but we are working to improve that. And then were you speaking
For that activity or anything else, do you have any other projections or hopes of how enrollment might grow organically or through some of your other enrollment efforts?
Yeah,
go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that we kind of came up with this approach of what we wanted to do to expand coverage last Tuesday night, so we don't have plans in place for that. It's an opportunity, I think, for HSD to convene a wide variety of shareholders here to come up with your ideas. Obviously, as many different points of enrollment as we have and we can increase, will increase our chances of bringing people into the system. So we've been talking about some of those, but I think there's opportunity to expand.
Yeah, thank you, no Mr. Chair. I don't mean to belabor it, but just that's a fertile ground, I think.
I think one note of importance is that rather than doing broad outreach and enrollment efforts, we really want to try to zero in on the populations that are left uninsured and do more targeted outreach and enrollment efforts and really focus dollars there to reach those people that are remaining.
Thank you very much. We'll now go to item number. Oh, we have some more questions. Okay, yes. Sorry. Yes.
Good morning. Did the Centennial T2O waiver, did that include addressing the issue of keeping coverage for kids under EPSDD from birth to 21?
I'm going to have to defer here to my deputies.
Mr. Chair, Nicole, nothing has changed around EPSDD coverage for it goes through age 20. So and children are continuously eligible as well. So we didn't change anything there.
Okay, and yes, Dr. Shammer.
And I really appreciate the effort to reach out those particular children who are eligible but not enrolled, particularly in rural areas. So I support that. Certainly supported if you one of the aims of expanding the provider base and access is to ensure that the providers are paid fairly and to rescind some of those decreases that we all took a couple of years ago. And then finally, as building networks and increasing providers, not to lose track of those social determinants of health that affect our children and others, so that programs for home visiting and other support programs are also an important part of the Medicaid program.
I can just briefly comment, Mr. Chair, that we have anticipated that there are economic variables that would stimulate provider growth. That's on our list. And actually, I'm not sure how, it's something that we're working on in the budgeting process as well.
Ruth?
Yeah, I know that, just want to bring it to everyone's attention, if you're not already aware, that there is an effort in this session for Medicaid home visiting, which is part of this whole thing, to have a piece of that be funded under the Medicaid program. So just make sure that you're aware of that.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
So for those that aren't aware, we do have home visiting included in our initiatives under the 1115 waiver. So we would be rolling out those efforts, or we're working to roll out those efforts in up to, I think, five counties.
I think it's three counties.
Right now,
it's a pilot program starting with about 300.
I think there's a little bit larger effort on that.
Very good. Any other comments or questions? Seeing that there are none, we will go to item 5 on the agenda, and I will turn it over to Jason Sanchez for Medicaid budget projections.
Great. Good morning to you all. It's great to be here before you. You do have a piece of information in your packet. It's a 14-page document. It starts off with the enrollment projection, which is a bunch of little numbers across the page. Top left-hand corner says State of New Mexico Human Services Department Medical Assistance Division, and the title of the center says Medicaid enrollment. Just want to make sure everyone is looking at the same information that I'll be speaking about. So just to kind of refresh everyone's memory, the overall Medicaid and CHIP population peaked in early 2017. And since that point, and then well into 2018, the projection reflects improving economic conditions, which of course have resulted in higher incomes as well as higher employment, which are a couple of factors that we look at in order to determine appropriate eligibility. So the enrollment is estimated to be at 840,000 and change individuals in December of 2018, and is projected to drop slightly to 837 and some change by the time we get to June of 2019, and then from there remains relatively flat to reach 838,000 individuals, almost 839,000 individuals, by the time we get to June 2020. So that's made up of a couple of components. Managed care enrollment continues to grow slowly, and we are continuing to see losses in eligibility due to our eligibility changes for family planning. And just to refresh everyone's memory on that, we are no longer covering individuals in our family planning program above the age 50, whereas previously there was not really an upper age limit. And again, just to further refresh everyone's memory, those individuals utilize very little, or in most cases, no services at all whatsoever. So overall, in our overall Medicaid enrollment, again, looks relatively flat, increases in managed care offset by decreases in family funding. So I'll stop there and see if there are any questions about the overall enrollment page.
Could I meet the women that used to access it over 50?
We can actually.
She's trying to make me.
She's trying to decide.
We're not doing this to promote lady life challenge.
Okay. With that said, we can go ahead and turn over to page 2, which is our managed care enrollment. And we've split this out for you into our three large managed care programs: physical health, long-term services and supports, and our Medicaid expansion population, also known as our other adult group. And overall, we're not seeing major changes in any of this enrollment. We have scaled back our physical health projection. It was previously at 1% growth. We've scaled that back to 0.5% growth. And we have left our long-term services and supports projection at 2% growth, and our Medicaid expansion population at 1% growth. So are there any questions about the managed care enrollment projection? Okay, hearing none, let's turn the page over to page number 4. So this is our FY18 projection. This is the budget that ended last June.
and this is based upon our LAG model, which includes actual claims and enrollment data and encounter data all the way through December of 2018. We're seeing a couple of areas that we're seeing change from our previous projection, and you can see the change from the previous projection in column K. The first one I'd like to start off with is row one, inpatient hospital. We are seeing decreases in utilization in our inpatient hospital projection, and that is telling us to project it downward, so we have scaled that projection downward by about $3 million. Moving on to line 12, which is our other category, we have actually collected additional dollars there from one of our contractors, HMS, and we have, due to that collection, expenses were reduced. We have scaled the projection for that line down by just about $2.2 million. So overall, our fee-for-service projection is down a little more than $6 million from where we were based upon the September data. Moving on into our managed care section, which is totaled in row 23, we have a projected decrease of just about $11.1 million. The majority of that decrease is tied to a penalty that we have assessed on our managed care organizations for not meeting all of our HEDIS performance targets. So with that said, that takes us to the bottom line, which is line 33. Those combined to indicate a decreased projection of about $17.4 million, leaving us with a total Medicaid projection for FY18 of $5,628,000,000 and change for fiscal year 18. Are there any questions about the FY18 LAG model projection?
And the year, the fiscal year being referred to here, the one which ended last June. But as you well know, the nature of the program is such that the bills are still coming in.
Correct.
The data is through December, but your columns label September, is that correct?
So are you talking about column J?
Yes.
Column J was the previous projection.
The previous projection.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Column H is the current projection.
Changed one.
H.
Correct. So we both on here can see the comparison.
Okay.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, the MCO penalties for failure to meet HEDIS that you mentioned, are those projected for performance in 2018 or are those historical but being utilized in 2018?
Those are for the fiscal year 18 period. So they're actual fiscal year 18 penalties.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, they're the calendar year 18 penalties, excuse me.
Gotcha.
So the hope would be there would be no more penalties, but we're not planning for any.
So let me make sure I get my dates straight. So we assess them tied to fiscal year 18 because that's the year in which we are making payments for that period. But they are, in fact, for calendar year 2017 HEDIS measurement.
Thank you. That's exactly
what I want.
Mr. Chair and Aaron, on those HEDIS measurements, do you have a sense of what was not met? I mean, that's a little interesting to me. That's a lot of measures that are not met.
Turn over to Megan Sheffer, our deputy, to answer that question.
So we had, in calendar year 17, we had 8 performance measures, and some had subcategories, so that was a total of 14 points. The way we approach it is each area has to improve by 2 percentage points or meet the regional average, and this was the second year that we had assessed penalties on it. They varied from each MCO. Some MCOs did well in dental visits, some did better in diabetes management, behavioral health, the other measures. But it wasn't across the board, everybody did poorly in one area. They focused on certain areas. Our goal is that with the penalties, they can refocus where their deficits are. So.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay.
With that,
another related question that Mr. Chair has.
Yes.
That might actually clarify this more is you said about maybe $8 million was related to not meeting penalties. How much money is altogether is budgeted? Like if the managed care companies met all of their HEDIS targets, what would that number be?
So we don't actually set aside an amount for HEDIS penalties. We pay them a full-fledged capitation amount.
Okay, so it's just
and then if they
that.
Don't meet it, then it's taken from them. So it's not a plus situation, it's a negative situation.
Let me ask another question. If nobody met any of them, what would have been the total deduction then? Do we have a sense of that?
It's a percentage of cap,
their
correct?
Total capitation for the year.
And
so
1%.
We did 1% in 2017.
Then there would probably be a meeting in the governor's office.
There'd be a lot of meetings.
There would be
a lot
of
meetings. So about $50 million potentially in swing. Is that
if
it's 1%?
Interject. A lot of the MCOs met a lot of the measures. There were only about two or three measures that they would need per. I think the max was 4. So out of 14. They're doing really well. They're just
having that's what I want. I
want
to have a sense of
yeah,
how bad is this?
So it sounds like in the math that I'm doing in my head, Mr. Chair, it's they hit 80%+ of the targets.
Okay, go ahead. Proceed.
So moving on into page 6, that's our traditional revenue page, which distributes the expenses by category, by the appropriate federal matching percentages. So that leaves us, if you look at the bottom row 33, we have an opportunity to collect $4.4 million in revenue based upon our current projection, which leaves us with a state need of just about $1.2 billion. And we can go ahead and turn the page to page 7, which actually details our state revenue collection amounts.
Thank you for
the program.
And
we are attempting to.
Much larger.
I know these were not. We could not send these legally to Medicare
recipients.
Well, it should be a 12.5.
Yes. Some of us you couldn't send them legally.
And we're continuing to tweak the information on here to make it both readable as well as provide the information that we need. So we're constantly evaluating that. But yes, this is a lot more readable than it was even 6 months ago. So moving on to the revenue page, there are no changes from our previous projection in terms of our operating transfers in and our other revenues based upon the changes in expenses that I previously discussed on the last pages. And we now have a general fund need of $908 million and change. We have a general fund appropriation, which is represented in line 63 of $915 million, for an overall state surplus of $6.8 million. We reverted with our June 30 financial statements, or shortly thereafter, $2.3 million. So that leaves us an opportunity to revert an additional $4.5 million as we move throughout the finalization of the FY18 budget.
Revert to the state general fund.
Correct. Question?
So is there kind of an average range in terms of reversion? I mean, obviously you can't know what enrollment will be, it changes. Is there a sense of it, or is it really different year by year? It depends on the jobs, market, the...
There are a lot of different factors that go into it, and it starts with the appropriate appropriation level. And in some years, the appropriation is not appropriate to what we're originally projecting, and certainly all of the things that occur during the time period from the time we actually receive the appropriations at the end of the fiscal year, a lot of things change. So, I mean, I guess to kind of summarize to answer your question, if we're in the plus or minus $20 million general fund range, no one typically is hugely excited.
And just from a historical perspective, back in the days, the medieval days, when Michael Spanier and I were struggling with the budget, there was no such thing as a reversion, and we were experiencing significant growth, close to 30% growth annually for year after year after year. It's only since the advent of the managed care contracts, Salute and then Centennial Care, that we've seen a variance and whether there have been actual opportunities for reversion.
Just wanted to show a note as well, and I'll get to you, Dr. Schuster, is that the Medicaid program statutorily has the authority to push expenses forward. So if we do not have sufficient funding in a particular fiscal year, we can take the balance of expenses that aren't funded by our general fund appropriation and push those into the subsequent fiscal year.
Mr. Chair and Jane, I was just going to size this one as well, that the reversion divided by the budget is like less than half of 1%. And so that's really good if we can get it down to less than half of 1%.
Thank you. Any other questions about FY18 revenue? Great, so let's turn the page into the FY19 projection. So some of the things that we saw in fee for service in FY18 are flowing into FY19. And again, FY19 is a lag model, meaning that it is based upon actual data through December of 2018. So much like we scaled back the inpatient hospital projection for FY18, we are doing the same here. We are seeing lower utilization, so we are scaling it backward by about $1.8 million. Line 9, that's not something we saw in FY18, but it's something that we're seeing in the data through December for FY19. We are seeing a lot more users, and those users have a lot more utilization in our other practitioners category. So we are projecting that one up by about $1.3 million. So that leaves us with a total fee-for-service projection change of about $3 million below where we were previously projected. And you combine all of the other additional items on it. Let's move into the Centennial Care Managed Care subtotal, and that we are projecting about $7.8 million less than we had previously projected. So a lot of different pieces of things going on there. The first of which, and we're monitoring this very closely, is the mix of population and how they have distributed themselves to each of their managed care organizations. So this is our first actual projection with the actual enrollment that we have seen for January of 2019 with our three managed care organizations. And just to refresh everyone's memory, effective January 1st, we went from four managed care organizations to three managed care organizations. So a significant portion of the population had to choose a different population or migrate to a different MCO. And we are monitoring that enrollment distribution very closely, and we are anticipating individuals making switches. They have an opportunity to make a switch over the next couple of months, and we do expect that some of them are going to make switches, and we'll monitor where they fall into each of the MCOs over the next number of months. The key to that we're monitoring very, very closely is that our MCOs aren't paid the exact same amounts. They are paid differently, so depending on where an individual falls, that can result in a plus or minus in terms of how much we're paying for them.
This is your question, Jason, so I'll ask it here. And how are we facilitating that for folks who are having to make the change and making sure it's seamless?
Sure, in terms of
transitioning someone changing from if they were with Molina or something like that.
Yeah, moving out of Molina and UnitedHealth.
Correct. So as most of you know, Presbyterian, enter into an agreement with United, so the United members transitioned to Presbyterian in September, and I felt like we learned a lot of lessons during that transition. And for the Molina membership, the open enrollment letters were distributed in September, and we've been working with the MCOs, the 2.0 MCOs, since September to track these high-risk individuals as they actively selected a 2.0 managed care organization, and then we had to wait for auto assignment in December because a small percentage actively selected, and then in December we auto assigned the majority of the population to a managed care organization and shared those enrollment files at the beginning of December with each of the 2.0 MCOs and tracked our high-risk membership with daily and weekly calls, reports,
but how have they dealt with the client themselves? So are they aware? Do they know where they are now? How is that going? As someone who had to transition on January 1st, can I know the system?
Yes. So starting in December, Ruth, they started to receive their ID cards from their 2.0 MCOs. There were active outreach efforts to high-risk members by the 2.0 MCOs to ensure that the transition from their previous MCO went smoothly, so there's been a variety of efforts in terms of making sure that these members knew, number one, knew who their 2.0 MCO was, and that their care was transitioned, their clinical documentation was transitioned to the new MCO.
And it would be interesting to see a report on that as it goes forward.
Great.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee, I was impressed that our governor, on her third day in office, January 3rd, convened the MCOs to actually personally assure that this transition was going smoothly. The three Centennial Care 2.0 MCOs presented their plans, their data. A lot of warm handoffs going on in this process between one MCO to the next to make sure we still, if we do get data about a member who may have fallen through the cracks, that's distributed and immediately acted on. Just to brag on our staff a little bit, I don't know what you all were doing on New Year's Day, but I know Angela Madrano was in one of the MCO offices all day, and we had other staff on New Year's Day, the day of the transition, just in case a member was transitioning from one plan to the next and had an urgent need that wasn't covered. Also, I know Mary, maybe Mary would want to make some comments, but their MCOs have done other things to extend their way of doing things to minimize the impact of people getting caught between two MCOs and with respect to contracting and authorizations. So
yes, I could add to that, Mr. Chair. There is in place a transition management agreement that all the managed care organizations have signed, and it establishes really transition timelines for key services like pharmacy, if you're pending surgery, if a durable medical equipment item was approved by the previous managed care contractor, we are to honor that. So the timelines are at a minimum of 60 days. They certainly can be extended longer beyond that with clinical review. So really our principle and what we committed to the governor in that meeting is that we would do no harm to the provider or to the member. We can work out the payment arrangements later, but let's make sure that the members receive the services, that if the provider is not contracted, that we would put in place a single case agreement to facilitate services until such time we have a conversation and negotiations with that particular provider about contracting status on a going forward basis. So I would add too that we started receiving the clinical transition files in October for the 1-1 start date for members who had selected us so that we could begin early, and I think that was a best practice really to put that in place so that we were already exchanging data, we were already working through the logistics of the transition for a specific member, even though they were not yet our member until January, so we can put all the steps in place. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, can you give us a sense of what the current distribution between the three MCOs is after kind of all this shuffling around occurred?
Sorry, turn to Jackie. Do you remember the distribution currently? I know it's about 10%, just about 10% for Western Sky.
I know.
Okay, but a little bit further. Let's hear that one more time. One more time.
57% for Presbyterian, 33% for Blue Cross Blue Shield, and about 10% for Western Sky.
Okay.
So 373,000 for Presbyterian, 216,000 or 18,000 for Blue Cross, and 66,000 for
did you just do those calculations in your head?
That's really good. No, it's actually the document that we discussed with the governor.
Okay, yes, Dr. Madden.
Jason, you had said the MCOs are paid differently. What were you referring to?
So they're paid individual cohorts based upon their individual grid rates from how they pay it based upon Centennial Care 2.0 procurement.
In terms of acuity and other factors?
So there's a number of different factors that go into how they bid their rates. We give them a cohort structure, which is a combination of individuals who fall into an area of age, gender, maybe a particular type of I don't know, eligibility categories, a number of different factors. And they bid a rate for that to serve that population in the managed care procurement.
And it's generally based on their estimates also, because, again, we don't know precisely how many long-term care patients they will have in their plan versus somebody else's plan. So those are many factors.
It sounds like it's a standard approach that an insurance company might take.
Exactly. Any other questions on that issue? Yes.
Yeah, I'm curious whether this has ever come up at the MAC before, or whether, Mary, if you're kind of representing the MCOs today, whether kind of reports related to pending contracts with providers and kind of the status, and particularly at the beginning of 2.0 and new contracts, and whether that's something that could be reported at the next MAC meeting, or I know things, it's always evolving and changing, but is there a way to do that?
In fact, I would respond by saying we have had numerous reports from the various MCOs with respect to some of the innovations that they have entered into, contracts that they've got with respect to care coordination, a whole slew of things. There might be some other things you might want to comment on, Mary.
Mr. Chair and Jane, we do certainly submit our contracting status, and we have throughout our recontracting efforts for 2.0. So as we're making progress to contract with the network or to expand with the network, we're certainly providing those reports so that data is available, and certainly make that available at this meeting.
Mr. Chair and Jane and other members, we've also been talking quite a bit about potentially commissioning a workforce capacity study across the state that would look at where we have shortages and would also identify where the contracts already exist. But for that data that is already available, folks are interested in seeing it, we can share that.
Very good. Okay. Jason,
yes.
You want to proceed with the report?
Yes. Sure. So continuing in the Centennial Care MCO section, we have an overall decrease projection of about $7.8 million. That's made up by a couple of different factors, one of which is the mix, certainly that I spoke of previously, which are based upon, again, the managed care bid rates, which have been adjusted to include a few additional things above and beyond what was known at the time that we actually had the procurement process in place. Largest of which is probably our Centennial Care 2.0 initiatives, and I want to go to row 29, and as you can see, we projected a $20 million decrease there. The majority of that activity has fallen into the actual rates above, so that's built into the rows 16 through 20. And then in addition to that, we've had some other additional things that have been built into the managed care rates. Our HICS assessment, our exchange assessment, has doubled from what it was in calendar year 18, in calendar year 19. It's gone from $15 million in terms of what Medicaid's portion is to about $30 million. So that's now built into the managed care rates and also accounts for an increase. And we also have embarked on a process with UNM, where we have a physician UPL, and that is also now built into the managed care rates. So moving on into row 24, we see a major decrease there of 6.7 in our Medicare Part B projection, and that is a one-time credit. The federal government has notified us that we have had a credit balance sitting with them, so we've taken that credit balance and applied it in this projection model. So that's a major difference in terms of the overall general fund projection.
We don't often get money back. It's a rarity, but it's all good.
Yes. All of the trending and all of our Medicare premiums have been increasing significantly over the mass number of projections in the last number of years. So it's great to have this bonus to kind of offset some of that. So we now have an overall projection for FY19 of just under 5.7 billion. A change of about $38 million from our previous projection. Are there any other questions about the FY19 budget expenditure projection? Okay, so turning a couple of pages, let's go ahead and move over into page 11, which is the revenue page associated with our FY19 lag model. A few things I want to point out there. Line 33, although we did not discuss the DOH projection changes significantly, it did not change significantly in terms of overall expenses, but we have actually made changes here on the revenue side. So row 33 is now at a projection of $102 million, which reflects a $1.5 million increase in revenue, and DOH was able to identify revenue from prior years, which they pushed forward into this fiscal year to help support their expenditure needs. Row 34, that projection really hasn't changed significantly, but I point it out because that is the balance that they have available from a $2 million appropriation. So they have about $1 million left from that balance. And that coupled with the projected almost $4 million deficit that they have in line 35 to meet the current projected expenditure needs leaves an overall net deficit of about $2.5 million for the Department of Health, excuse me, $2.8 million for the Department of Health for their overall program. Line 42, the UNMIGT, I spoke just a little bit ago about their UPL that we have embarked on with them, and they were projecting that they're going to fund the general fund portion of that UPL, so we reflected that increase in projected revenue here in line 42. Moving on into line 51, which is our drug rebate projection, we have looked at the latest data through December for our drug rebates, and we are projecting a decrease in the projection of about $2.2 million. So with all of those changes, moving on into row 60, we now have a general fund need of $933.4 million compared to our general fund appropriation of $933.6 million. We now have a surplus of about $0.2 million or $200,000, which is 8.3 different from where we were previously. So instead of needing a supplemental appropriation, we are now projecting roughly flat expenditures from a general fund perspective for FY19. Any questions about revenue for FY19?
That's the current fiscal year, by the way.
Yes, Jeff.
Mr. Chair, adjacent to the question of the collection of safety net care pool dollars from the counties, is that on track or is that just prorated by year or on track? Or
that is on track. If you look at the collection year-to-date column, the $13.7 million, roughly about half of the total, and that's kind of where we should be based upon being roughly half through the year.
Are there any particular counties that are having difficulty with it?
Not that we are aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Jason?
Yes, Dale.
In the past, there used to be a projection of pharmacy expenditures, and that was taken out quite a while ago. But we had the dashboard that was furnished to the MAC in the recent years or so. Are we going to get those, still be able to get those? Because that's the only way I had of knowing what pharmacy expenditures were even looking like.
Yeah.
And so that was really helpful for me.
Yeah, we still plan to share those dashboards, and since this meeting was short and focused on the budget, we didn't bring it, but it will absolutely be available at the next one, and if you'd like it in the interim, we can get it to you.
I would love to have it. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Go ahead, Jason.
Okay, so moving on into page 12, a lot of the things we've already talked about throughout the three-year projection cycle that we're identifying here, you're going to hear very similar to in FY20. Which is our trend model, so it's based upon the FY19 projection with various trending factors moving forward to get us to the FY20 time periods. So much like we saw in the previous two projections, we've scaled the inpatient hospital projection down by $1.7 million tied to lower utilization. Much like we saw in FY19 in row 9 for other practitioners, we've seen additional users and utilization, so we've projected that one up by about $3.1 million. Row 14, our traditional DD medically fragile VBO waiver projection, we are projecting an increase there of $1.1 million above where we were previously. And the majority of that comes from adding a new service as well as increasing rates to medically fragile waiver service providers. So moving into our managed care alliance projection, overall change in row 22 of $12.4 million in terms of a projected decrease. A lot of what we talked about in FY19 applies here. Sort of the mix of the population, the rates, the increased HICS assessment, as well as a full year of the UNM UPL. FY19 only reflected a half year because it started 1/1/19, so this reflects the full year of that UNM UPL projection from 7/1/19 all the way through 6/30 of 2020. So that accounts for the majority of the changes in our managed care rows. A couple of other areas that I want to point out, row 29, we have projected that a decrease in that particular line. A lot of those initiatives ended up, or a good portion of those initiatives ended up in our managed care rates above. But there are also remain initiatives that were built into this projection model that are currently under discussion that we want to continue to project going forward. Health homes expansion, our health homes is one of the ones that's there. ESPR, adult detox, additional SUD services based upon how our waiver actually shakes out are also built into that line there, as well as some potential activity for SNCP, our safety net care pool providers. So we projected that downward slightly, but we do have significant opportunities to further our initiatives that we implemented in Centennial Care 2.0. Row 30, we have a $4 million projection there, which wasn't there previously, and that is to support the initiatives that Secretary is in disgrace, Director Como, as well as Jane Wishner was referring to previously. So we built in $4 million to be able to address some of those initiatives into this projection model. So overall, we have a projection of $5.9 billion, which is about $15.9 million less than what we are projecting based upon our September data. Are there any questions about the FY19 trend model? Okay, Carolyn.
I don't know, Mr. Chair and Jason. I'm always interested in what other practitioners means. Can you tell me who's included in other practitioners?
I'm going to look towards Jackie and hope I remember the answer. But in essence, it's anyone who's not an MD who has services provided to our clients.
Does that include dental?
No, dental is included in other.
Jason, just a little point. You mentioned there's a new service, the medically fragile PD waiver. What service do you remember what that is?
I do not. The new service, the medically fragile, the service we added?
Oh,
EMOS.
Environmental mods, yes.
Environmental.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Okay, any other questions? Next, Jeff.
Sorry, Mr. Chair and Jason, you mentioned safety net care pool changes for 2020, and there is a significant change in the waiver, the way uncompensated care is handled. And is that part of your projection for some downward projection on safety net care pool? Our understanding with the previous administration, and hopefully you could take forward, as that is all shaken out and adjusted as we deal with the new waiver definitions, that the offset to rate enhancements to offset the declining uncompensated care. How is that philosophically built into any of 2020 at this point?
So the base SNCP program and the uncompensated care and HVI program are built into the projection as it exists currently. And we had additional, so that's built into the base. As you recall, in the Centennial Care 2.0 initiatives, we have built in additional dollars to expand that program further. Those initiative dollars are continuing to be maintained in that line 2094. We've not had any discussions or any conclusions in terms of what we're going to implement in order to maintain that program going forward, which, like you described, CMS has expressed concern about how we're operating that program.
So to paraphrase that, do you see this line 29 to be the holding place to sort all that out?
929 is a holding place to sort out a lot of our Centennial Care 2.0 initiatives, not only SNCP, but there's a lot of other pieces built in there, like ESPRT and others that I mentioned previously.
But it's just carrying over from 2019, carrying it over in a linear way into 2020 for the time being.
I wouldn't quite phrase it that way. I would phrase it that we built in $64 million tied to overall expenses associated with Centennial Care 2.0 changes. We're currently maintaining $56 million of that. That's not built into the rates above. And a lot of it, again, is expansion, changes to the program. Health homes, I think, is a perfect example where we have a certain level built in, although our projection and our Centennial Care 2.0 waiver identify major areas of opportunity for growth in that program.
So it does include some major factors that have been built in.
It does.
Any other questions?
Okay. So let's turn over to the revenue page. So a few things to point out. Row 34, which is the DOH additional need, we're projecting that they're going to need an additional just under $4 million, which is an increase of $342,000 than we were last projection. Row 41, UNMIGT, this reflects an increase there associated with the full year of that. The UPL and UNM putting up the match for that UPL for the full year. So that leaves us in row 61 with an overall projected need of $994 million compared to our FY19 appropriation that is of $933 million. We have a difference of $61.2 million, which is $9.8 million for a difference from the budget request and about $2.2 million from where we were based upon our previous projection. Are there any questions about the FY20 revenue page?
This is what will be acted on by the legislature.
So, correct. We have two legislative hearings this week, Senate Finance on Wednesday and House Appropriations and Finance on Friday.
Okay, Carolyn.
So I have a general question then with this sort of the bottom line here. At the beginning of the meeting, we talked about 30,000 New Mexico hospital. So it's really two. One is, can we absorb the 30,000 within this budget? And two, who makes up that 30,000? Is it children? Is it adult? Who makes up that 30,000
So the answer to your question is that that uninsured population is distributed across the entire spectrum. There are some children, probably more heavily weighted towards adults. But it does, we've looked at some of the data, and there are opportunities for our uninsured individuals across the entire spectrum of the population.
And the budget can absorb the 30,000?
So I would say the budget cannot absorb the 30,000.
Okay. We talked about quite a bit what we thought was feasible in this time period and what we thought enrollment might look like. So we didn't anticipate getting the full 30,000 right away. But we did build in to the budget some money to cover a good portion of that population with these outreach enrollment efforts.
So I want to point to two specific areas. So there's that $4 million that's built in there that's currently built at zero match. So we could take some of that $4 million and use it to match and match it and use it for individuals, new individuals that have come on the program. We also have some opportunities within our managed care structure, including that Sentinel Care 2.0 initiative line, to have some opportunities to be able to do some things there. The administration's priorities fall along those lines.
And it's good to keep in mind that with a state of 2 million people, about 800,000 Medicaid eligibles, that's a substantial portion of the population. And other states are sort of rushing forward to purchase Medicaid coverage as a method for trying to cut into the uninsured numbers. So, okay, any other questions, any other comments anyone wants to make? I think some of us sit here sort of a little stunned in terms of the numbers. They're very large. It reminds me of many, many years ago when we were first doing behavioral health with children in Medicaid. We decided to do a pilot project, and I ran into our chief financial officer at the time and said, you know, we need another $8 million to be able to cover this pilot project. And sort of laughs and says, we're not changing budget. He says, that's a rounding error. So these are the sorts of figures we're talking about. So, okay, seeing that we have now completed our agenda, are there any other comments or issues that the members of the committee wish to bring up? Yes, Dr. Strace?
I had just one comment, because I know there's a large number of folks here representing various provider groups. And we just, on behalf of HSD and the Medicaid program, we want to thank you all for the work you're doing to take care of our members and people in the state. We know that the rates impose economic challenges sometimes for small practices in particular, but the work you do really is... As I've been saying lately, you know, we're not delivering babies and giving flu shots over at the HSD building on Rodeo Road. You all are doing that work or organizing that work or helping with that work, and we just want you all to know how grateful you are, how grateful we are for what you do. You probably are grateful because you and have the chance to interact with them and help so many people, but we really appreciate it, and we just want to be officially say thank you to each person here who's involved in that work. So thanks.
We want to thank you, Secretary Scrace and Nicole, for being here, and the members of your staff, and Jason for the wonderful work you always do. Jason has become the real authority on the budget. We go to him every time we've got a question. So
Mark, thank you very much for being here today, too.
I just want to second what you just said.
And we look forward to a very healthy working relationship. We serve at your pleasure, so don't forget that. And So, if there's no further business, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved
by Dale, seconded by Mary. All those in favor of the motion to adjourn, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, we are adjourned. One hour.
Good job. Nice to see you again.